Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Thursday, May 21st, 2015. It's just after 2:15 UTC as we're recording this. I'm Sam Minter, and Yvonne Beau is once again not with us. I'll mention a little bit of that in a second. But we have Jen Steele filling in, who's been listening to us for a while and commenting a lot on our stuff. Welcome to the show.
Hello, and thank you.
So, Yvonne was expecting to be here this week, but apparently he's in some sort of business meeting conference thing, and he's like, he texted me earlier today to say, basically, he hasn't been getting out of his meetings and getting back to his hotel room till like 11:30 at night. Now, I'm presuming the meetings themselves aren't going till 11:30 at night, but, you know, it's one of those things where you have sort of business dinner, then business drinks, then I'm just guessing here, but I think it's that kind of thing. So we missed 2 weeks of Yvonne in a row, but we've got Jen. So
anyway. Sam, I've always had a question that I want to ask you.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
What's your obsession with UTC?
Well, I have answered this before, but it's simply like from going back probably till high school. I realized that this whole time zone thing was stupid and I didn't like it. And I went through various variants of how to deal with that. So for my first, version of this was actually like, I remember in high school realizing before I did the time zone thing, even the first thing that bothered me was that months and years and days started at one instead of zero. So I went through a phase for a couple of years where whenever I dated my work for school, I would subtract one from the year, month, and day.
Oh, that probably didn't confuse your teachers at all.
No, not at all.
Not at all.
And I did that for a while. And then I learned about this thing called the Julian date, which is the number of days since a fixed exact date and time in prehistory determined astronomically that is also set to sort of zero on that scale was before any known historical event. So it's basically, you know, a long number and then a decimal point and then a fractional day. And right. And I got a... I had a scientific calculator at the time that had the ability, I forget if it was a custom program I entered or whether it was built in. I think it might have been a custom program, but that would, given the current time, spit out this. And so then I started dating my papers with that.
Lovely.
And then eventually I sort of submitted to a little bit of reality, only a little bit, and just settled on, okay, I'll write the normal date, but I'm going to stick with UTC or Greenwich Mean Time for the time, because it doesn't make sense that they're time zones and that you're always having to convert, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, or at least specify to know what time it really is. You always have to specify. And then you have to worry about savings time and all this kind of stuff. And so I just didn't like that. So I've been on UTC. All my devices are on UTC. My computer's on UTC. Yes, my phone's
on UTC. I remember that.
Everything's on UTC. With the exception of any place I have sort of an analog clock that only has 12 hours on it, I will put that in local.
It's really hard to put that in UTC.
Yeah.
Although I guess you could kind of do it and just...
But it's still sort of... Yeah, the whole 12-hour thing throws everything off, too. Mm. Yeah, I don't like that either. It should be 24 hours. Having said that, I have a 12-hour analog clock on the wall next to where I'm doing this right now. And I should mention, Jen alluded to having known about my UTC thing before. Jen was previously an office mate of mine at a previous job of hers, one that I'm still at. So we've known each other outside of the show as well. So
we have.
And we do have an actual show with actual topics planned. So we are going to talk about the Boston verdict and you know, the ramifications of that, death penalty, how that works, federal versus Massachusetts versus all of this kind of stuff. We're going to talk about, this was a topic suggested by Jen, who's been, you know, on and off in the Silicon Valley area doing things there. And she wanted to talk about the cult of the engineer and Silicon Valley life. And I heard that and was just like, that's interesting. I want to hear the take on that. I want to hear the rant that is probably going to be coming here. And then finally, we'll do a roundup of sort of election 2016 news. There are a bunch of little things that have been happening. Nothing really super big this week, but a bunch of little things, and we'll talk about some of those. And then we'll finish it up, of course, with a lightning round with a bunch of small topics. So that's the plan. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back, and we'll jump right in with Boston. Back after this.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
Okay, we're back. So, Boston, you know, the bottom line, I can never pronounce the guy's name. How do you pronounce the last name?
Oh, don't ask me. I have no idea.
Sarnov something? I don't know. Anyway, you all know who I'm talking about. The one of the Boston bombers who survived. His trial ended a little while ago. The sentencing phase ended this week, and he was sentenced to death. Which, you know, a lot of people figured, you know, it's probably going to be life. I know I was sort of thinking it's probably going to be life, but nope. And Jen, I know you've lived at least part of your life in Boston and have some connections there. So why don't we start with, you know, what your take is from as a former Bostonian and someone who knows people there. What was your reaction? What was their reaction? What do you think?
Well, okay, I did spend 20 years in Boston, actually. That's where I've lived longer than anywhere else. And I have Boston politics, right? I'm the flaming liberal. I don't call myself a progressive even, et cetera. And because people in Boston are like that, they're a lot like me. And the basic reaction that most of us had was honestly one of disgust, because we don't support the death penalty. And I was proud at the time that I lived in Massachusetts to live in a state that didn't have the death penalty. It's a point of, like, thank heavens I'm never going to have to be on a jury where I even have to think about this, right? Mm. Thank goodness that we get to make decisions that make sense as opposed to, you know, killing somebody to show that killing somebody's wrong. And so there were a few things that really pissed off me and so many of my friends in Boston. One was that the death penalty happened at all. You know, it was on the table. It was annoying that way. The other was how they stacked the jury, right? You couldn't serve on the jury if you couldn't vote for the death penalty, which means that it was almost a foregone conclusion. I know that you said that you assumed that life would happen. But once I heard about how the jury was selected, yeah, I was then.
And this is actually this is completely standard in death penalty cases, because the notion is, if you were opposed to the death penalty, you might actually be more inclined to acquit in the first place if you knew the death penalty was on the table, or once they got there, you would, you know, go for life or whatever. And so it's these death qualified juries. If you're in any case whatsoever where the prosecution is going for the death penalty, the basic logic here is, if you are not comfortable with that penalty, then you can't judge the case according to the law, which says that needs to be a possibility.
Which just shows me that's just so ridiculous. It's like, if you're uncomfortable killing somebody, as everybody in the world should be.
Uh-huh.
If you're uncomfortable with that, you can't serve because you might be tempted to acquit to, I don't know, save somebody's life, no matter how despicable a human being they are. I don't see this as a bad thing. Like,
well, and not to say, you know, most people in that position would probably actually go ahead and vote to convict, but then vote for a lesser sentence at the sentencing phase. But the worry is, of course, that it's going to bias the whole proceedings. if you have folks who are adamantly against the potential penalty. Now, I agree with you. Just to put the cards on the table here, I'm anti-death penalty as well. I don't think it's an appropriate punishment that we should be engaging in. The conversation that you and I had on Twitter on this topic earlier in the week, I've said on a number of occasions, not just because of this issue, but for all kinds of other reasons, that the whole process of jury selection is just warped in many ways, not just to avoid people who don't agree with the death penalty in this case, but in general, for instance, in any case that involves scientific evidence, they don't want anybody with any sort of scientific or technical knowledge who might be able to provide, an actual knowledgeable, reasoned opinion on the evidence that's presented to them. They want blank slates that the defense and prosecution can impress on however they want. Similarly, they tend not to want lawyers or people with expertise of the law. They generally speaking, to put it bluntly, they want dumb people.
Yeah, dumb and uninformed. Right, because you shouldn't have heard anything about the case either, in theory. I realize with something as big as Boston bombing, that's like impossible. But
right, but in general as well, yeah. If you've the fact that you want somebody who's never even heard anything about the case means you're going for people who don't keep up with the news, don't do this, don't do what that, and also there are all kinds of biases in terms of there's this whole industry of trying to do psychological profiles on potential jurors and pick ones that are going to or reject the ones that you feel are going to be, would tend to vote against you, et cetera. My take on all this is get rid of all that stuff. You do the jury selection by the random lot, and then you get what you get. And if you get a bad draw, too bad. If you get a good draw, too bad. And I guess people can put in, their extreme situations here. Like, what if one of the jurors is your brother?
Right.
If you're doing it completely randomly in a large locale, those kinds of situations are unlikely. If you're picking a jury pool for a small town, that might be a much bigger issue. I think you can sort of deal with those in another way,
there's the legal concept of conflict, right? So I worked in a few law firms once while I was in Boston, and cases would come through and people would do a conflict check to make sure that folks in the firm who would be in contact with a case wouldn't have basically a legal conflict with it, right? Like
a direct
relationship. Yes. Yeah. So it would make sense to be able to conflict out people in the jury.
Right. And the thing is, that's the kind of concept that expands over time.
Like, I think it has.
Right. I mean, that's exactly what happens here. Initially, the conflict may be, you're a direct relative or friend of this guy. But then it's, you have heard of him before, or, he's the same ethnic group as you are, you've got a conflict because you don't believe in the death penalty.
That goes too far. You've got a conflict because you don't want to kill somebody. It still boggles my mind.
that's what we got at the moment. And absolutely, I read a couple articles after this showing that these death qualified juries not only, of course, are willing to consider the death penalty, but when you qualify them this way, they're often biased towards that outcome.
Shocker.
They're much more likely to choose the death penalty than other options. And more so, they're more likely to convict in the first place.
Oh, no. But is that because they're willing to convict because they're willing to entertain the possibility of the death penalty, which is kind of
I think they're
just bloodthirsty assholes?
I might not use those terms, but it's sort of like the people who would consider death as a penalty tend to be much more likely to, for instance, believe that the prosecution is probably right, that the police are telling the truth, that, you know, there must be something bad about this guy, you know, regardless, you know, those kinds of arguments. And, you know, I'm speaking off the top of my head here. I don't know if there's rigorous proof of all those things, but it sort of, you know, makes consistent sense that those mindsets often go together, whether it be a subconscious thing or not. You know, so you can see those kinds of relations. And so the other thing, of course, here is that even if the prosecution could do this, there's the question of, you know, should they really have gone for the death penalty in the first place, given local sensitivities? Now, one of the things that's been pointed out is that while Boston is very much against the death penalty, and the nation as a whole is somewhat ambivalent on the issue as a general concept, it's fairly close to 50-50 at this point. When polled specifically on the Boston bomber nationwide, it's on the order of 60-65% want to kill him.
Well, yeah.
And so that's, you know, the logic behind, you know, the federal prosecutor is basically like, if they didn't go for the death penalty, there'd be all kinds of political pushback and ramification about, you know, Obama's Justice Department being weak on crime. And I can't believe they're, you know, they're letting the Boston bomber live.
Well, they also charged him with every permutation of every count of everything. And of course, then the jury found him guilty of every single one of them, even stuff his brother did. It's like, how could they not throw the book at them because of that whole, that administration, oh my gosh, easy on crime and here's a terrorist and da 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 da. But come on, how ridiculous can you get?
And that's in part, like, it, you know, in many cases, they hold back some of the charges in case that something goes wrong with the trial, so they still have something else to charge him with for a second round. But, you know, they were so sure of a conviction here, they didn't bother with any of that. And, you know, I understand all the logic here, but I wish that we were not at a point where, you know, this is sort of the knee-jerk reaction that happens here. And I understand, like, you know, most of the, you know, there are a lot of anti-death penalty arguments. The ones that tend to go over the strongest with the general population, though, are things like, you know, what if we execute an innocent person? And look how many innocents are being vindicated all the time. And,
oh, yeah,
and we've proven this. And, you know, you didn't have a lot of people doubting this guy's guilt. Whereas the more abstract arguments against the death penalty of, hey, it's just wrong to kill people, maybe we shouldn't, just don't resonate as much because, you know, a very large portion of the population doesn't view it that way and fundamentally says that, yeah, if somebody's a bad guy, yeah, we should kill him.
That boggles my mind. I admit it. I don't see where that comes from, but you know, I'm a bleeding heart liberal. What am I going to say?
Yeah, yep. Well, that about wraps that up. anything else you want to say about this case before we move on?
I think I have ranted enough. If I rant anymore, I'll just repeat myself.
Okay. So we'll take another break. If anybody out there, by the way, listening to this, wants to come on and argue the pro-death penalty side of this, I'd be very interested in hearing it. So drop me a line. All the contact information will be at the end of the show.
I don't want to be on that show, just for reference.
We'll take a break. We'll be back after this.
entering your conference account information.
Okay, here we are again. So, Jen, Silicon Valley, tech companies, the cult of the engineer, what's the rant here? I'm guessing.
Oh boy.
I can guess what this is, and I think I share some of these thoughts, but I'm just guessing here, so go for it. What's going on here?
Well, just to give you a little context, Silicon Valley is not like anywhere else. You know, at the company where we work together, I know you've talked before on the show about the cult of the engineer and how you love working with the engineers, but there's definitely a bias. You have seen absolutely nothing until you moved to Silicon Valley. It is batshit crazy down here. Like, just insane. And so Silicon Valley has a few phenomena that I have to admit drive me insane, probably because I'm not really part of the privileged class in this case. There's the cult of the engineer. I'm not a developer. I have a technical background, but I don't write real code. And developers, you know, cough and sneeze and find jobs, and they can just, the salaries they demand are hilarious. And I don't complain very much because my husband's a developer, so, you know, that's not the end of the world. But the other phenomenon down here that I find so annoying is that I call the freaky man child. And that is that I swear to you, most of these startup CEOs should actually be in a homeless somewhere and unable to hold down a steady job. So, and then
are you thinking social skills here? What are you? Why?
Okay, look, you know, I went to MIT. I just, you know, we went to tech school. Social skills are not high on our list of must-haves. Okay, it's not. I have to admit, they were things that I learned the hard way. Mostly, you know, it's not really high on my list. And sometimes I don't even consider showering regularly high on my list. Not for myself, but for the people around me. I've had to relax some of my standards. But these people are so enamored with ideas that nothing gets done. And they're so enamored with the strangest ideas. Well, I mean, everybody's heard of Klinkle, which is the whole, you'll pay with the sound, and some 22-year-old CEO got millions and millions of dollars, and now the company is just exploded or imploded.
I haven't heard of that one, actually.
Oh, Klinkle? Yes. Klinkle, yeah. Hilariously, they were trying to recruit my husband for a while, and now they're down to like 7 people after getting millions and millions of dollars, and for a while, they only had a slide
deck. With a noise?
Yeah, but then it morphed into like an online wallet, but then that space was crowded and morphed into something else, and et cetera.
So now one of the things that's interesting before you move on there is you mentioned this sort of enamored by the idea and nothing actually gets done. You know, the outside reputation is certainly that there's all kinds of ideas churning and people are trying all kinds of different things, but it's not necessarily from an outside point of view that nobody's getting anything done. It's more, you know, everybody working these, you know, huge long work weeks and nose to the grindstone and playing a lot too, but building stuff, some of which is stupid and crap and fails, some of which succeeds.
Most of which, yes.
But that, you know, stuff is happening. And so your view is
it is despite them.
Okay.
It's because people like Sheryl Sandberg come in and get shit done, right? Mm-hmm. It's because actually VCs try to do this with the young, stupid CEOs with the good ideas, that they surround them with people I call the elder statesmen.
Right.
Who are people like, well, me and even older, which is a little strange for Silicon Valley, you know, people who have a lot of industry experience, maybe in a lot of different things. They've worked at big companies, they've worked at small companies, they're former executives somewhere, you know, and that's fine. But I can also tell you it's painful to be an elder statesman and to be like, you read that on a blog, didn't you, sweetheart? Okay, do you really want to try this? I'm not kidding. It's like, and then everybody's like, oh, let's go read this book and let's all do this. And it's just like, well, that's fine, but we haven't executed on our last strategy yet. Yes, but we should do this instead. And this is endemic here. Mm. And so that's why I call them freaky man children. First of all, unfortunately, they're mostly men. And second, because nobody told them that at some point you have to leave the playpen and do something real.
Okay.
So there's that.
So
Go ahead.
I just want to hear a little bit more of that. I mean, so you feel like there's, you know, just every once in a while somebody gets really, really lucky, and it's more despite the culture than because of it. Because I mean, a lot of people make the argument that the culture of Silicon Valley and all this crazy experimentation is what actually results in the successes there, and that you couldn't reproduce this in sort of a more adult environment, let's say.
I see that to some extent. I mean, I see what they're saying, and it's because nobody would come up with things that were this crazy and throw millions of dollars at things that were this crazy if it hadn't worked a few times. And it worked here, so everybody thinks it has to be done here, so all the crazy people move here. Not that I miss Seattle or anything. But I actually think that this freaky man-child ends up playing into the cult of the developer, right? Because you need somebody to develop your ideas who will be enamored with them and who will also spend the rest of their time drinking beer and playing foosball. And I'm not saying beer and foosball aren't fun, but when you're trying to get a product out, it can be a little bit frustrating.
Right. And you would definitely have the reputation there of, you know, sort of the work hard, play hard thing. You know, long hours, but interspersed with random, you know, hey, let's go, you know, like you said, the foosball or the Nerf battles or, you know, miscellaneous random video games. And you see companies outside of Silicon Valley trying to reproduce this stuff and mostly failing. But, you know, and I look at that, you know, and, you know, I'm, you know, over 40. And so I look at this kind of stuff and I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. You know, let me do what I need to do
and then
let me go home. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now see, I do like hanging out with people inside work. And I think that's fine. And I actually really appreciate strong bonds with people inside work. Mm-hmm. Because when you're in a really stressful situation, then you tend to hate each other a bit less if you actually like each other as human beings, right? It's much easier to handle the crunch times.
But is the way you want to bond, you know, a Nerf battle?
Not really. Actually, I flinch really easily. Sometimes that's a problem. There was a point in time that when I was at HubSpot, I couldn't walk through one room without a guy that I know and love to death shooting Nerf dart at me. And of course, I'd be off in my own little world and suddenly get hit by this and be like, what? Yeah, it was a thing.
So now, you know, I know one of the things you said on Twitter as well is that, you know, have you on sometime when it's time to talk about gender issues. So I can't let you talk about Silicon Valley without mentioning gender issues, because there's been a lot of coverage in the last few months and before, of course, but in the last few months about the culture and, you know, the thing that's gotten the most press is specifically in the gaming world with Gamergate and women involved in game development being harassed, but also expanded out from that to the whole tech industry in general. And all kinds of tech companies have been slammed by various ex-employees in terms of the environment being hostile and sort of an extension of this man-child thing that you mentioned, but played out onto, you know, the men versus women dynamic and sort of an ingrained sexist culture. So take a few minutes.
Sure. So I have a 10-year theory of gender. And that is that as a woman in Silicon Valley, I am in my career where I would be 10 years earlier as a man.
Okay.
So the people that I'm competing with for jobs are 10 years younger because, you know, heaven forbid you're 30 and looking for a job. But women don't get promoted as easily. Women don't fit as well into the foosball and beer culture. And it shows. There are very weird signals. When I go to an event, I'm usually wearing makeup. I'm dressed in not a t-shirt and I have, you know, good shoes on, etc. And all the women around me are like that or dressed up more. And all the men around me are wearing jeans and sweatshirts.
Right.
It's a very strange dynamic. there's also just the fundamental assumption that if you're a man in Silicon Valley, you're a developer. And if you're a woman in Silicon Valley, you're looking for a man or something. I'm not really sure what, you could be in marketing. Uh-huh. You might be in HR, but you know, it's a little weird if you're something else. And you just watch it. But I can't tell you how many, well, I was the only woman in my first company for a while. I was the only woman in my second company. I've gone to all sorts of events and have been the only woman in the room. I am just extraordinarily accustomed to not having a, not talking to a single woman when I'm interviewing at a company.
Right.
Or if I do talk to a woman, she's lower level. And clearly they pulled her in just so I could talk to a girl.
Huh.
So, and I know that, I mean, I've obviously seen this before. I've been in the tech industry for a long time. And I've been part of this conversation for a long time. But where in Seattle, maybe I saw some gender stuff at work, but I never saw it outside of work, right? Going out to bars or whatever, it just wasn't there. Here, it's just out there. There are so many men and so few women, and so many of the women have a baby carriage, or so many of the women... I mean, there are entire neighborhoods here where it's basically like the culture is. So a friend of mine, when they first moved here, his wife didn't have a job at first. And they lived in an area of San Francisco where she's just like, I swear to you, all the women of this entire neighborhood just go out and have coffee with their, you know, strollers all day. And they just sit there. And she's like, what's going on? This was mind-blowing to her because, of course, she was a pretty high-powered person that was just, you know, looking for a next job. When I go to events, it's like, oh, whose wife are you? And it's like, well, thanks. Have a nice day.
Right.
Yeah. And I feel lucky because I'm accustomed to that environment. You know, having gone to MIT back before they did a really big effort to recruit women and being in tech, I'm super comfortable in the environment. But I know that I'm the exception rather than the rule. And so as I try to mentor like Gen Y women who are coming up, they're just looking around going like, what the expletive deleted? Like, seriously, what? Why do I have to say things twice to be taken seriously? And they've got a point.
Do you see or have you seen directly a lot of the sort of out-and-out harassment that, you know, have seen recently a lot of people complaining about?
I mean, I've seen some of that most of my career, sadly. And I definitely blast music when I'm walking down the streets of San Francisco. But I don't know if it's just that I'm not very attractive, but I don't see a huge amount of direct harassment, at least not to me. Or maybe I'm just better at you know, giving people dirty looks. Mm. When I do go to events and trade shows, there are people who are like, hi, and I'm like, wedding ring, you know. So it's more, though, it's more subtle. It's more just not being taken as seriously. It's the basic assumption that I don't know anything about technology. And that's clearly frustrating and clearly off-putting. And so I feel like if Evelyn Powell had won the case against Kleiner Perkins, because we all know she had a case. We all know that what she was describing was what happened. I've heard it. I've heard CEOs talk about this, you know, at hotel bars and things like that. We all know that, but you know, if she had won, then maybe we could have more conversations. But instead, it's just yet another thing.
And
that
just as the background, she sued because she didn't get promotions she thought she would have gotten through discrimination, right?
Right, and they claimed she didn't get promoted because of her personality, and right. I'm like, that to me is instantly coded for that. That means you're gendered. Right, we weren't comfortable with you as a human being because you're different from us.
Right. Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is clear. I mean, I have in my own personal experience a number of times, and obviously I'm not a woman, but I've been in situations where a colleague of mine who was female you were in a room, it's a bunch of men and her. And she makes some point that's absolutely correct. And then other people in the room just start ignoring it. And then I've raised my hand and essentially repeated exactly what she said. And then they're like, oh, yes, yes, that's a great point. And it's like, well, yeah, that's what she said a minute ago.
And that's happened to me countless times. I actually had was fortunate enough that when I first got here, I worked for a company that that listened to me. And I was so surprised in the first meeting. I said, you get what I say the first time I said it. And they turned to me and they said, which time are we supposed to get it?
Right.
I was like, well, the first, but I'm not accustomed to that.
Okay, well, we're at the end of the segment.
Do you have a timer? What's going on here?
I have a bell. We just hit 15 minutes for this segment. So we're going to take another break, and we'll be back, and we'll talk election stuff for a while. Back after this.
This is a break. Oh, yes, this is a break. This is a break because no one gave me any suggestions. I told you, I warned you. So this is a break. This is a wonderful break. A wonderful break. Yes, indeed, this is a break. This is a break in the middle of Curmudgeon's Corner. Yes, this is a break. Yes, yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, 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 this is a break. Yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, it is a break. And now, and now, and now, and now the break is over.
Okay, we're back. And I, in this segment, vow to completely ignore Jen's opinion because she's a woman and interrupt her as much as possible.
Is that good? Sam, have you had a woman here on Curmudgeon's Corner before?
Not as a full-fledged co-host. I've had a number as guests occasionally. We had somebody on I've had my daughter on a few times, actually, as a co-host, I should say.
Woman.
Yes, although it's been a couple years, so she was under 18 at the time.
Okay, girl. We'll go with that. Still female.
But, going back a few years, we had a couple of people on to talk about one subject or another. But, I admit it's not common. It's not common. It's usually just me and Yvonne blabbering on. And, of course, we're male.
I noticed, yes.
Yeah.
And it's not to say that you always have to artificially include somebody. I was just curious after all the gender stuff.
Yep. So, anyway, election stuff. So a couple things came up this week. One, George Stephanopoulos was going to host one of the Republican debates. And then it came out that he'd donated a fairly substantial sum to the Clinton Global Initiative a while back. I forget how far back it was. And so he has now recused himself from that debate, which is interesting in a couple of ways, because, this is supposedly like, well, he's biased because he gave all kinds of money to the Clintons. But of course, he used to work in the Clinton administration. And he's openly, friends with them and has had long relationships with them going back many, many years. So, okay. So he gave some money to their charity, as have lots of other people, including, I believe somebody pulled up that, the Bushes had actually donated to Clinton's charity as well.
Oh, sorry.
I'm not sure. Like, this seemed like an excuse to jump on it, because, I mean, his background as a Democrat and as a Clinton Democrat specifically was well known. It's not like this was some sort of secret that, oh my God, we discovered he's not an impartial news person. He's, a host of, a news-related show that came from the world of politics where he had, he was very partisan. And then it brings up sort of, well, okay, who do you really, what would be the ideal, for, hosts for these things? Is it the, sort of impartial news person, theoretical that of course doesn't really exist in real life? Or do you actually want should the Republican debates have a diehard partisan Republican, as the host, so that they can really dive in on, the issues that separate Republicans, because I think part of the, and of course you can mirror all this over to Democratic debates if you have any reasonable ones, it is You know, because otherwise, you know, is it really the right thing to do to grill people about essentially what are general election questions during the primary process? Or do you want to really get at the things that differentiate the people within the party, and who's the right person to do that? I don't know, but I'm not sure it's the impartial person. Of course, the other approach would be you want a partisan from the other party, because, you know, but I don't know. I think this is a sort of crazy non-thing with Stephanopoulos. It's like he would have done an okay job, not a great job. You know, most of these debates are fairly neutered to begin with. Nobody tends to ask you know, questions that are really gonna surprise or shock anybody. You know, they're fairly staid usually, and they're controlled and structured in that manner. I mean, the formats are set up to try to not get anybody in too much trouble. The moderators are chosen to be people who aren't going to go too far off the reservation, and you know, so I don't know. Any thoughts on that? No? Yes?
I don't really have much of an opinion on the who hosts the Republican debates, because I can't watch. I get so angry. I just can't watch. It's sad. I know I should be more informed, but yeah.
Well, you're going in starting with the position that, you know, it doesn't matter who it is. I'm not voting for him. So...
Yeah, I kind of hold my nose and say, okay, I'll vote for the conservative Democrat because that's how I consider everybody who's running. So, I mean, I'm not exactly aligned with the Republicans.
Right. So anyway, continuing on with the debates then, the other thing that was announced just a few hours before we were recording this is CNN announced their format for their debate. And one of the things that we've talked about on previous weeks here is at this point, the Republicans are coming up on 20 candidates, you know, and that's only the semi-serious ones that you've heard of. It's not the complete crazies who are just filing for presidency because they feel like it. And how would you deal with 20 people on stage? How would you deal with, you know, what if you're going to have a 2-hour debate and 20 people?
I mean, I'd
people,
release the lions, but that's just me.
But, you know, because it's just, it becomes a zoo. And if you remember some of the debates from 2012 and 2008, there were just so many people on stage, nobody got to actually say anything. There were some candidates who got more attention than others, and generally it was the ones that were doing better in the polls, which kind of makes sense. But, you know, and you had a lot of sort of gimmick questions like, okay, everybody who supports this, raise your hand. Because there just wasn't time to actually get answers from everybody. And so CNN's solution is they are splitting their debate in half. And the first half is only going to have the top 10 candidates in the polls. And the second half is going to have everybody else.
Which means nobody will watch it or something like that.
It wasn't entirely clear to me. I admit to only seeing the headlines here. These two groups don't mix, so it's the top 10 and then the bottom, or do they bring the bottom folks on but leave the top 10 guys on?
I'm not sure about the CNN rules. I was more looking at the Fox ones, which limits it to 10.
Oh, so Fox is just 10, period.
Is 10. So CNN's going to split in two.
I think the only way it would work for CNN is if the top 10 leave the stage and then everybody else comes on rather than trying to mix them, because then you get back into the too many people problem. But, you know,
I still like the idea of brackets that came up on this show.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's kind of what CNN's doing, not fully, but I mean, they're basically separating the field into tiers.
Right, they're doing power pair, as we used to call it in debate. People of the same rank debate each other.
Right. And so, of course, the question is, how exactly do you tell? I mean, who is the top 10? What are you looking at the latest CNN national poll? Or are you looking at the latest polls in Iowa and New Hampshire? Are you looking at some sort of poll average?
So I think they're going to do an average of the last 5 most recent national polls.
And
if they were to do it today, I guess the top 12 are this is according to the Washington Post. Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Scott Walker, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Huckabee, Ben Carson, Chris Christie, Donald Trump.
Of course. Got to have Donald.
Rick Perry. And then there's almost a two- or three-way tie. Yes, there's like a three-way tie between like Perry Santorum and John Kasich. I don't even know what these people's names. Kasich. Thank you. See how I'm such a Republican. And then lagging behind those 12 are Lindsey Graham, Bobby Jindal, Carly Fiorina, and George Pataki. And so Yvonne might be disappointed by not seeing Carly on the Fox debates, but
She'll make CNN.
That's true. That's true. And of course, the Washington Post then pointed out, like, without Fiorina and Jindal, we're talking about all men, most of them white. Right. Yay.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting, too, even if you pick people like this with the polls, it's been pointed out that at least for the early debates, at this point in time, until you start having debates, these polls are driven 90% simply by name recognition. I mean, you mentioned as you got further down this list, I don't know who this person is.
Like, I don't know.
And, you know, Republicans don't know who they are either, unless you happen to come from the state that this guy came from. And so you have a strong effect of, you know, why is George Bush or George? Why is Jeb Bush and near the top of this? It's because everybody knows him.
Name recognition. Totally.
You know,
and I keep mixing up like Scott Walker with Scott Brown, who had Elizabeth Warren's Senate seat in Massachusetts. You know, like
they're both Scott.
They're Republican Scots, whatever.
You know, and so all the people at the lower end of that scale would argue that this is exactly why they need to get in the debate, because that's where people will get to know them. And if they're excluded from the debate, basically you're having a reinforcing loop that says, well, obviously they're not serious, they're not into debate, forget about them. And so you end up having the people who are selecting who go on these debates are actually the ones narrowing the field, not, you know, the voting public.
Right.
And, you know, I can see that argument. But, you know, the reality is, at this stage in the process, that's kind of what it is. It's even more narrowed by the fact that, you know, it's not just, you know, who gets chosen for the debate. It's also, you know, who's raising money. And that is very much determined by how well known you are, how well people perceive you might do, and which may or may not have any relation to how you would really do if you actually got the nomination. But, you know, so it's just how things work. Sorry. Yes, it
really
is. It is a popularity contest. Surprise.
It's a voting contest, for crying out loud. Of course it's a popularity contest. Duh.
To wrap up this segment, just a couple other things. We talked a lot about the Republicans. The other thing they've got is they're still having difficulties figuring out how to deal with the Iraq issue, because they're trying to juggle the fact that the general population has long ago decided that it was a mistake versus going to sort of the dead end basers on the Republican side who think that, no, the Iraq war actually was an okay thing to do. At least with what we knew then, which I tweeted an article earlier today. Everybody go look at Abel Smay for the links. It was James Fallows from The Atlantic, I think, basically on if you knew then what you know now, would you do it, is an incredibly stupid question, both in general and also very specifically on the Iraq question. As opposed to, say, something that would actually let you learn something about the candidates, like, what have you learned based on what happened in Iraq over the last 15 years? You know, something like that could actually give you some insight into somebody. Anyway, they're all having a really hard time, with the exception of Rand Paul, I should say, who's been consistently saying, yes, it was a mistake. It was a mistake then. It's a mistake now, blah, blah, blah. But everybody else on the Republican side has been really stumbling, trying to figure out a coherent answer they can give that would please all their constituencies at the same time.
Good luck with that.
And so it's just been amusing watching all of it.
I just feel like they should, well, it's interesting because I remember there's been so much Republican name calling throughout the years of Democrat flip-flopping. And I'm just like, you have a choice. You can flip-flop or you can flounder.
Right.
Or you could say something dumb. I mean, or all of the above, but you know.
And yeah, I mean, if you aren't willing to say, I mean, you know, there are a lot of arguments, and that article I mentioned also mentions, you know, hey, it wasn't really, you know, them making a decision based on the evidence they had. They made the decision to go to war and then came up with the evidence to support that. But even otherwise, if you can't say, you know, I thought that then, but subsequent events have shown me that I was wrong, then it seems like that's a fundamental quality you want in somebody, to be able to recognize when they made a mistake and do course corrections in the future based on that. But as you said, the whole flip-flopping thing counteracts that. A large portion of the American population wants their leaders to be so damn sure of their position and that they are right and permanently right that they will never, ever, ever change their mind about anything. And that boggles my mind, because no, I want someone who's willing to look at new evidence and change their mind if the evidence shows that they were wrong. Duh.
Details.
We're at time. But I did want to mention Hillary real quick to give a little bit on the Democratic side. The latest thing that there are two things that the Republicans are going on about in terms of Hillary right now. One is, of course, donations to the Clinton Foundation and this fees she got for speaking personally, and who exactly was paying, you know, $300,000 for a 1 hour speech, and were they trying to influence her, and blah 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 blah. So that's one thing, and I honestly think there probably is a seed of a real issue there, in terms of all of this. And the thing is, it's not unique to Clinton. Of course, it's the entire political class in this country is the whole going out and getting money from people and having that money influence what you do is unfortunately a very deeply ingrained part of our system right now. And so is it, you know, did Hillary Clinton do that too? Yeah, probably. And is it surprising? No. But I think you're going to see a lot more on that over the next, you know, year. You're going to see a lot about that in the disclosures and, you know, is there a conflict of interest and did she actually act on anything based on any of those these donations? And everybody's digging for a smoking gun that'll actually be some sort of quid pro quo relationship while she was Secretary of State. And I don't think they'll find something that's so clear that even Democrats will say, oh yeah, that was bad. But, you know, they're going to keep trying. And if they do, it'll be an issue. But I think most likely we're going to continue to dig up things that just everybody gets their own opinions reinforced. And so Republicans will say, oh my God, look what Hillary was doing. That's so evil. And Democrats will be going like, so what? There's nothing there. And nobody's mind will be changed.
Shocker.
And finally, the other Hillary thing was that she's been getting a lot of criticism for not answering questions. She officially announced, a little over a month ago now. And she's taken very, very few public questions. I mean, undoubtedly in the little events that she's doing, she's talked to people, but there've been very few things that have been caught by reporters essentially. And this is driving people nuts because, of course, the Republicans are getting hammered every day with these tricky questions about Iraq and things like that. You know, and so why isn't Hillary having to answer questions? And it's driving the press nuts. It's driving the Republicans nuts. And the reality is it's because so far she doesn't have to. She's not in a position where she needs to. And she's strategically decided to do a lot of low-key, small events, in Iowa, et cetera. She's campaigning, but she's keeping a remarkably low profile for someone campaigning at this point. And it's because she just doesn't need to. She was criticized last time around for not doing this kind of small scale local thing in Iowa. So she's doing it this time. And any of these opportunities to have a big conversation and be asked questions. Yeah. Every single one is a opportunity to accidentally stick your foot in your mouth. And, she will do all that stuff eventually when she feels she needs to. But so far she hasn't had to. I actually did notice, today and yesterday, she made a point of answering a couple minor questions here and there. Nothing, really noteworthy. Undoubtedly that's in response to this, but she's not going to do anything before she has to. Because she's in a leading position right now. Obviously, in the Democratic side, there's still no serious competitor to her. All the polls against the Republicans right now still have her winning comfortably. Not landslide material. The way the public is divided right now isn't you're not going to have a landslide in either direction anytime soon, absent some major thing happening that changes the dynamics. But a comfortable margin. And so she doesn't have to go on a limb. She doesn't have to do things that have no real upside, but only the possibility for screwing things up. So she's going to keep doing this, and it's going to continue to drive people nuts for a while.
And the press will pout, and the Republicans will pout.
Yep, pretty much. Anyway, I think that's it for that. We're over time by 5 minutes, so we're going to take a break, and we'll come back with the lightning round. Back after this. We're back and it's lightning round time. So as usual for what we've done lately, 15 minutes total for the round and 2 minutes each for each segment. And Jen, you go first. Go.
Me? Okay. I've got to talk about the POTUS tweets.
The POTUS tweets. Yes.
This made my week, seriously. So for those of you who might not know, President Obama joined Twitter as @POTUS.
To the various accounts he's had before and other guises.
As opposed to what he's had before, et cetera. And I think he's trying to say, hey, no, it's really me. But then what ensued was possibly my favorite Twitter exchange of all time, except for a few that I've had with you, Sam, of course.
Of course.
He introduced himself saying, hello, Twitter, it's Barack, really, 6 years in, and they're finally giving me my own account. And Bill Clinton, who is, of course, @BillClinton, said, welcome to Twitter, POTUS. One question, does that username stay with the office? #AskingForAFriend. And that was good enough. But then POTUS responded and said, good question, Bill Clinton. The handle comes with the house. Know anyone interested in @FLOTUS, i.e. First Lady.
Right, First Lady of the United States.
Which, of course, it would technically be Bill Clinton, whatever we'd call him. First gentleman.
Yeah, I mean, people have thrown around first gentleman, first guy, first whatever. Of course, the reality is in Clinton's case specifically, they'll come up with something cutesy and work with it. But as a former president, his title remains president.
But then it gets confusing as all hell. We have the president's Clinton.
Well, we had the president's Bush.
That's true, but not not living together.
That's true. That's true. But, you know, probably what the Bushes did, you know, they were 42 and 44 or whatever.
Right.
And going by their numbers. And actually, you know, in some of these charity things where Clinton has done things with the Bushes and stuff, they've, you know, they've all gone by their numbers, which I think is just kind of amusing. Because, you know, there's also this thing, and I was trying to ring the bell but hit my mouse instead. Where there's this buddy-buddy relationship that's actually gone on between the Bush family and the Clinton family, with Bill Clinton and the elder George Bush did a whole bunch of charity things together and, you know, actually became apparently fairly close friends after their presidencies were over. And so George W. Bush has called Clinton his adopted brother. And so, you know, really, if we end up here with a Bush versus Clinton race here, you know, they're like brother-in-law, sister-in-law or something.
There we go. You know, I would like a civil race. It would be nice.
Oh, no, it won't be civil.
I know.
No, it won't even be close. Okay.
Your turn.
My turn. I just wanted to mention, I am not a sports fan, but I did look at sort of the highlights of, Romney in his little boxing match.
Oh, thank goodness. I thought you were going to talk about Tom Brady's balls. Go ahead.
No. And I just thought it was amusing. It was just so out of place and non sequitur that, you know, Romney was in this little fake boxing match, and it was fake. There were no like real punches thrown. They were laughing.
Well, he would have died.
Who was it he did it against? I'm blanking on the name already of the boxer. But anyway, they had the little thing. And, you know, the one thing, though, is, you know, you can see in this interaction.
It was Holyfield, by the way.
There you go. So Romney versus Holyfield. But you could see Romney acting like a real person. And generally speaking, since he lost the election, in the times that he has sort of surfaced, absent his little flirtation with running again this time, he's sort of been personable in a way that you didn't see during the campaign.
And you didn't see in Romney, Massachusetts either. I lived in Massachusetts when he was governor.
And you didn't see that then either.
No, he was just as much of a stuffed shirt.
Yeah, but you see them sort of relaxed and, you know, doing fun things and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it reminds me of Al Gore as well, who had the same kind of issues where after he was done politically, he loosened up a lot. And in both of these cases, you're like, if they'd done that during the actual election, it would have significantly increased their chances in both cases. Because a big part of what people didn't like about them was the whole feeling that, you know, they're robotic, they're inhuman, they're just analytical, and they're not like the whole someone I could go grab a beer with thing. And both of them lost points because of that. And then after the fact, you see them, you know, loosening up. And it's just interesting to see, but, you know, too bad for them. Okay, your turn again.
Okay, I think I have to go with the Upper East Side wife bonuses.
Okay, so. and like I had no idea what this was when Jen put it on our list earlier. So what is this?
On Sunday, an opinion piece came out in the New York Times by, I believe, some sort of social anthropologist who moved to New York's Upper East Side and started spending time and started studying the society, right? Because that's kind of what she did. And she ran into folks she called Glam Sams, S-A-H-M-S, stay-at-home moms.
Okay.
And the most controversial part of this piece, I mean, the whole thing is just this glimpse into the life of the wife CEO, basically, who runs their hedge fund managers' wives who have more money than God and run their homes like CEOs. And the most controversial piece is that according to the article, some of them get bonuses for doing this, like a year-end bonus based on, I don't know what metrics, because I don't want to go there. And some do get them, and some don't get them, and sometimes they're actually written into the prenup or postnup. And then a few days later, so I guess yesterday, the New York Times came out with another piece saying, hey, we've actually talked to the Upper East Side wives and these bonuses don't exist. So I'm not sure if they exist or not. I don't know that anything that the super rich do would actually surprise me. So when I read the first piece, I really was like, oh my gosh, they get bonuses. Holy crap. I mean, I guess these are women with degrees from the best schools and with business degrees. I mean, they know what they're doing. They've given up their jobs to basically run the lives of these super wealthy men. Heck, they probably deserve bonuses. I mean, okay. They're working their asses off.
Okay, there you go. Okay, my turn. I just wanted to, we have neglected, it's been a couple weeks now, but the UK did have an election, and it surprised everybody because all of the polling was basically saying it was a close neck and neck race, and it turned out not to be. The Conservatives ran away with it. And so there's some questions on what does that mean towards polling? What does that mean towards, you know, polling averages and what they tell us for the American elections? There are a couple of things on that. One is this is another data point in Sam's theory that the real bias in polls is not towards one side or the other, but is towards making things look closer than they really are. Because I haven't done a proper study of this. I really want to, but I don't actually have time. But you know, just based on the last three or four highly visible elections that we've talked about, this has been consistently the case, where when you actually graph things out, you know, it looks like the bias is actually towards closeness as opposed to towards one side or another. It sort of compresses the margins and makes things look closer than they are. And so I think that's interesting. I wish I had time to actually do the proper research that across a whole bunch of different elections to see if this is just coincidence or if it's just I'm noticing things that aren't really there, which often happens, you know, like, you know, that little creature flying outside my window right now. I don't know what it is. Anyway.
Okay.
But I think that would be an interesting study. If I don't get a chance to do it, I wish someone would. The other thing is, of course, the UK elections are not directly applicable to the way the US works. Because of the way the parliament works, they were doing national polls, but trying to extrapolate local seats from that. Whereas the only real way to do good predictions there would have been if they were actually polling each and every constituency for the parliament, and they're too small to get really good polls on. So there are a lot of challenges that are very UK-specific, whereas in the US you're polling states, which generally speaking are pretty big. I mean, you get the same kind of thing when they're national polls that try to extrapolate the Electoral College. There is some potential of error there, although unless it's a really close election, they tend to track each other fairly well. But when you're looking at the states, you know, you're polling a whole state. It's a fairly good big region. You should get a pretty good signal. There is still the opportunity for bias there, as we've seen in other cases. But it's a different animal with different things at play than the UK election. So I don't think you can read directly from one to the other. Okay, your turn again.
Why do we care about how many times Osama bin Laden rewrote memos?
Okay,
so
now
this morning.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was just going to say, a bunch of documents were released, right?
A bunch of documents were released. But the thing that got me was, so I was doing some research because I was coming on this show, and I have to confess that actually most of my knowledge of current events is either based on Curmudgeon's Corner or on Facebook.
Excellent.
So I'm not the greatest on all of this.
This is the way to be as well-informed as you could possibly be in the world.
There we go.
Just listen to these two things.
I knew that I had to actually become the informer instead of the informee. So I pull up CNN and there's like breaking news about these documents. And then I click through to the piece and there's a couple of lines that I just had to bring to this esteemed forum because it was ridiculous. It was like bin Laden was a meticulous editor and some of the memos he wrote were revised as many as 50 times. Why the hell do I care about that? I'm sorry. And why is this breaking news? My other the other line that just drove me insane was, like, in the letters that Bin Laden exchanged with his many sons and daughters, he emerges as a much loved and admired father who doted on his children. And in a letter he sent to one of his wives, he even comes off as a lovelorn swain. And this was top news on CNN.
You know, there might be newsworthy stuff in these documents, but these two things don't particularly seem like it. Although,
you've gotta be effing kidding me. Yes.
Although I admit, though, it is interesting in sort of painting a picture of him as a person. And I'd be interested to see, like, if someone was writing a biography of Bin Laden, this is the kind of stuff that would go in there. But it's not necessarily breaking news, you know?
Yes.
And I think part of this has also been brought up on the timing of this, because part of last week we talked about the Seymour Hersh piece on Bin Laden and Bin Laden reign. And one of his claims was that there weren't really documents like this captured because he wasn't really on his own there. He was a prisoner for years. And so that this whole thing about this trove of documents was made up. So, of course, a few days later, they released the documents.
Dismissed as coincidence.
Yes. Okay. My turn again. And I just wanted to mention, I think I've mentioned this on the show a number of times before, but it's really getting to the point where it's bothering me now. I'm in an upgrade or wait situation on my iPhone right now, where my iPhone is old. I know it needs to be replaced. The battery is completely shot. I'm now using two different external battery cases that I switch back and forth throughout the day. Because not only is the battery shot, but it's burning more battery because I think it's a problem with the new Photos app, burning more battery than it should. But I think it's also slow. It's doing it. I think this is Apple doing one of their things where they let hardware upgrade to one version past where it probably really should upgrade to. And so it's taxing it more than it would. So I'm really, really frustrated with my iPhone at this point. I want a new one. However, we're more than halfway through the upgrade cycle for an iPhone. I know the iPhone 6S Plus or whatever is going to come out in September, which isn't that far away anymore. So I'm like, oh, because I'm usually one of these people who tries really hard to time their upgrade cycle to match the, you know, I get something in the first couple months it's out when it's new, you know, and this time around we didn't, you know, for budgetary reasons. My wife and daughter both upgraded their phones. Their phone situation was worse than mine, or at the very least I was more willing to put up with it. But now I'm in this, you know, zone where I want to upgrade, but I'll be pissed at myself if I can't wait for the next one. And so I'm like, I really, really, really want to wait till September. But at the same time, I'm like, but it's driving me crazy.
So I waited. So yes. I had a 4S and I waited until the 6 came out. And it was extraordinarily painful.
The wait, you mean?
The wait, especially those last 6 months. I don't regret waiting the last 6 months now, although I wouldn't mind having a smaller phone, but because the 6 is large. But yeah.
Well, because I'm in exactly that thing where on one hand, I know the new phone will be better and newer and I will regret not having waited. But at the same time, I'm at the point in the cycle where every day I'm swearing at my phone.
You can also do less stuff with your phone.
Whatever.
Oh, I get the bell rung for that one.
Your turn again, and I think this is going to be the last one.
My turn. I thought you had some feedback on here.
Oh, I do have some feedback, and I have one other thing I want to get in.
I'm going to cede my turn then to you.
We'll just do two more. Go.
I don't really have another one. That's the problem.
Oh, you're just trying to skimp out on it.
Okay, fine. Let's talk about the Google Maps N-word issue.
Yes. And this, of course, follows directly on the Google Maps robot peeing issue.
Yes. So if you apparently Googled N-word house, it would take you to the White House, which was obviously a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the articles I've read, they're like, some inappropriate results are surfacing in Google Maps that should not be, and we apologize for any offense this must have caused. Now, from what I understand, though, the Android robot peeing on the Apple logo, which is hilarious, but I thought that was the public map maker tool, Was that the problem?
Yes, it was the public map maker tool that originated it, but things get promoted from there into the full-fledged Google Maps.
Got it. And so I'm going to assume this is a similar problem.
Yes, I believe so. And they, as a reaction to all of this, they basically shut down user-contributed additions to maps right now until they can completely revise their process to try to better protect against these things. Because they had a process, but it was mostly automated, and so it was easy. It was apparently easy to game and get things through, and they don't want to go to a completely manual process.
I mean, the N-word, okay, this was the slang term ending with an A, as far as I can tell from what I see with the grayed out piece. Mm-hmm. You should have a filter. Duh.
You would think. But no.
Apparently not.
And obviously, images and shapes are a little bit harder to
I'll
do that with.
I'll let them go with that one. That happens. But this is a word.
Yeah.
Words are very easy to pattern match.
That's true. But I guess this is one of those situations where, you know, they figured this wasn't an area where people will abuse it like this. And guess what?
Please.
Any place where people could do stuff, there will be people trying to abuse it.
Maybe it was a freaky man child assuming that would happen.
Yes. Okay, my turn to finish up. And you mentioned feedback. I did have feedback on the list. We got feedback from Mark this week, but I'm actually going to skip it and leave it to next week because it was a question specifically to Yvonne it related to his vacation to Disney and kids.
Yes, so, I'm useless for that.
So we'll save that. But I did have one other thing that I wanted to say. I finished a book this week. It was an actual like reading book, not Audible book, on Kindle this time, which was Stormfront by Buchner, I think is his name. I don't know how to pronounce it. Anyway, it's basically a combination genre mixing thing of a private detective novel, but the private detective happens to be a wizard.
Okay.
And it's apparently the first of a whole series of books. I had it on my list because my wife liked the series. I read it. It is okay. It started out kind of slow and I wasn't so sure about it. By the end, I was like, oh, okay, this is okay. This is not by any means profound literature that you're going to remember
for
life.
This is Jim Butcher.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
the Dresden Files. I'm a big fan of the author and these books. Yeah,
Stormfront is the first book in the Dresden Files.
They're worth continuing to read because he eventually gets over kind of the sexist pig stuff. I really did not mean gender to be a theme. I promise you.
Yeah, yeah, sure you did. So you've read these two?
I've read them all. Yeah.
So why didn't you recognize the book when I was describing it?
Because Stormfront's a generic name.
Okay,
And the last name's Butcher, not Bruckner.
I was just mangled the pronunciation.
That's fine.
So the series is worth continuing.
I think of it as mind candy. It's just a fun. They're fun little reads for me, and they're great for me commuting because I commute by train. So
yeah, and I'd say that's the category I put it into. This is not profound stuff. This is not stuff you'll remember forever. But it was an okay, entertaining read, and I was going to continue with the next one on the series to see what happened next. I understand that there was a television series based on this that only lasted 12 episodes.
I did not see. I haven't seen the TV show.
But apparently it exists. I have not seen it either. But anyway. Interesting book, and that's the end of the show. There you go. As usual, you can get a hold of me or the show. Look at us on our Facebook page. That's what we're pushing the most right now. Comment there. Give comments, share, blah, 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 blah. You know the deal. I'm also reachable on Twitter at Abelsmay. Oh, our Facebook page is Curmudgeon's Corner, of course. I'm reachable at Abelsmay on Twitter. And you can email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com if you don't like any of those social media things. And Jen, where can people find your stuff? Both web, Twitter, whatever you have.
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter at Jen Steele. That's at JennSteele. And you should probably be prepared for liberal and feminist stuff. Also wine.
And also you've warned me, don't just Google your name.
Do not Google Jennifer Steele.
Right.
Jennifer Steele is a porn star. I'm Jen Steele, J-E-N-N. And while you can't ever get all the porn results out of your name, when there's a porn star that shares it, you'll be more likely to find me.
There you
go. I also blog on leadership at leadinggeeks.net.
There you go. And thank you very much, Jen, for joining us this week. It's been good having you.
Thanks for having me.
And with luck, we'll have Yvonne back next week for a quote-unquote normal show. And in the meantime, yeah, like tell your friends. Let them know about the wonder that is Curmudgeon's Corner and how their life will be enriched by listening to it. Anyway, have a great week, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye.